God,
grant me serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Tonight, our 40-minute speaker is Joe C. from San Diego.
Hi, everybody. Joe Conroy, alcoholic.
Hello.
Kind of serious with those microphones. Thanks, Mike, for asking me to come up here. Lose my phone number now, will you, please? This is pretty cool. I haven't been up here for years. I don't know what I was going to say. Totally forgot it. But I actually came up by myself. Chenoa, that's why you're the leader tonight, by the way. I wanted to be alone. Oh, my God. And you read that story. That's one of my favorite stories, by the way. I actually transcribed it and give it to all my sponsees when they're whining about him or her, whatever it is. And it was really cool. I wanted to be alone. This is a very selfish thing. My windshield was broke. So every time I was in my car, it was like driving in a wind tunnel. And I got my windshield fixed today, and I was just dying to get in the car to drive up here. I'm from North Carolina, too. I was just waiting for the Carolina people to start fighting.
Yeah!
But I love being sober, and congratulations, Ben. I could have just listened to you all night, man. That was cool just to listen to that. 2 years of sobriety, you know. It's like, and if you're new, 13 people said they were new. I counted it, 13. So there's probably, using the 10% rule, 1.3 people. So it's probably a pregnant woman who's in here that didn't want to say that she was sober tonight. So I know that for a fact, because that's the way I was when I first got to sobriety. I didn't want anybody to know I was new. I was, you know, I wanted to be well wrapped and together. And I'm still that way today. I don't really want to be here tonight. I'd rather be at home because I've got all these Sons of Anarchy recorded and I haven't watched them. And I'm just like, I am hooked on this show. It's just crazy. And I was actually thinking of them here. What am I missing? But I've been sober since January 1st of 1989. So if I don't drink going on the way home, listening to my own story on the way back home, I'll be 25 years sober at the end of the year. And I was with my sponsor the other day and his sponsor. And I said, hey, I got to work the steps. I got some issues to clear up before I turn 25. And he says, okay. So last Sunday, we started working the steps together. My sponsor's got 43 years of sobriety. His sponsor's got 44 years of sobriety. This is after two slips. He had 8 years of sobriety, slipped, came back in. Then he had 16 years of sobriety, slipped. Now he's got 44 years of sobriety, 96 years old. And he's you would never know it. You would never know it. He told me a funny story the other night. We were actually at a meeting, and he told a story about Mike, I think, was it you? No, somebody else was just talking about giving a tape away of this group. The history of this group is like since 39 or something. But Bob actually had a big book, his first edition big book, signed by Bill Wilson, Bob Smith, and Jim Burwell, who's the guy that wrote the dog, God As You Can Understand Him. Stuff. He was actually got sober down, didn't get sober in San Diego, but he came out to San Diego and helped start a lot of meetings. And he was at a meeting years ago, so this is probably 60 years ago, I don't know. And he was with a newcomer, and he said, hey, you need a book? He says, yeah, take my book and come back next week, and we'll go over it. And he gave him the book signed by all those three guys, and he never saw the book again. Yeah, and those books are worth a lot of money. I don't know if you know that. That's, you know, it's crazy. A book signed by Bill Wilson, the first edition, is sick what it goes for on eBay. It's just sick. So anyway, I'm not from Southern California, if you didn't figure that out yet. 12-2, the Red Sox won today. You know, I was pretty excited about that. That's where I was born and raised, in Boston, just south of Boston, not in Boston. Sometimes I say I'm from Boston, and the people from Boston don't want me to say that because I'm not from Boston. Who gives a crap anyway? But anyway, I moved out here drunk. I moved out here drunk in 1988. And I wanted to be a surfer, and I wanted to be like discovered, and I wanted to have long blonde hair, and that never happened. You know, none of that stuff ever happened, and it's never gonna happen. But I thought I was coming out here for something else other than sobriety. And what happened before I got out here was I was 12-stepped in Boston. I worked at a comedy club for years, and there was a comedian that I absolutely hated. This man, I couldn't stand this guy. And then I found out he was 8 years sober, which really pissed me off because I didn't like sober people. I tended bar for years, and I didn't like sober people. Why would I want to like sober people when I tend bar? I get people drunk. And then this guy 12-stepped me one night when I told him I had a little problem with drinking, which you don't want to. I could tell anybody, you know, I could tell anybody who's not a sober member of AA that I got a problem with drinking, and they'll just try to talk me out of it. They always did, you know. And when you say something to somebody who's like practicing these principles and all their affairs, and it's like you're giving them a chance to like help you. I didn't know I was doing that, and I got to take my coat off. I'm burning up. And he 12-stepped me, and I didn't know what that meant. I didn't really know what sobriety meant. I didn't like this guy. I didn't like anybody who hung around him. I thought they were a bunch of boobs. And if you're new here, that's okay if you think we're a bunch of boobs, because we really are a bunch of boobs, you know. But I haven't had a drink in almost 25 years, and I'm boobier now than I was when I was drinking. I'll tell you that much right now, too. I love drinking, but I really like being sober. I don't know why. When does that happen? When does that change? You know, when this guy was 12-stepping me and he's going on and on and on about the crap I'm going to go on and on and on tonight about happiness and joyousness and freeness and all this stuff. And I'm like going, shut up, you know, just like get away from me. Why did I even ask this guy anything? Why did I tell him that? I don't want nothing from this guy at all. And I'm just listening to, just trying to be polite. And you know, we don't shut up once you let us go. We just can go on and on and on. And he did. And then he finally said, Joe, I don't know if you're an alcoholic at all. I don't know nothing. He says, but I do know that if you're done drinking, you'll never have to. And you ask some power greater than yourself for help, you'll never have to take another drink as long as you live. I'm like, wow. And my solution to that was to pack my bags and move to California. That was it. That's exactly what I did. I was within 2 days, I was in a car driving out here with my brother from White Plains, New York, in a Mercedes-Benz with two dogs in the back. He worked for this really wealthy guy who lived up in Santa Barbara, and he was driving the car out here. The car was for the dogs. So, and they were great dogs, but they were dogs, you know. And we're driving out here, and I'm like, he says, what are you going to do, dude? And he called me dude. I don't know why. But I said, I don't know. I'm going to end up in San Diego. That's my destination. And that was it. And I ended up in San Diego, on the streets of San Diego. Not really on the streets, but I was on the streets, but not really on the streets. In Montecito, I bought this 63 Ford Falcon station wagon, which was just pissa. It was just the greatest car in the world. And that became the Casa de Jose, because I was kind of living in that thing for a little bit. I came down to San Diego, and I lived down at Ski Beach. I told everybody I was living at the beach. I was at the beach. I was living there at the beach, but I really wasn't living at the beach. And I would pull into the parking lot of the airport at night, because sometimes I was afraid, I was scared, and I would go in the parking lot of the airport and I'd sleep there, and then I'd get up and I'd go in and grab a newspaper that somebody left over, and I would read the newspaper, and then I would get in the car and drive around. And it was like, wow, this is really cool. California's a really cool place, you know. And you talked about that loneliness. That's what started to sink in. I'm drinking still, and I had a job lined up. That's the reason I came out to San Diego, was to get a job. I was going to drive one of those stupid tour buses, you see. I don't know if you guys got them up here, those orange, like they're fake trolleys, and they're in every big city now. And I had a job lined up to get this job. I mean, I had an interview lined up to get this job. And before the interview, I went and had a couple of beers. That's what I did, because I'm afraid normally of going anywhere. And I had a couple of beers and I went in. And it came back. The guy called me on January 1st, 1989. That's my sobriety date, January 1st. He called me and he said, Joe, we got some bad news for you. You tested positive for alcohol in your system. And all I could think of was this boob, Dick D, back that said, Joe, there'll come a time when you're done drinking. Anybody else could have to help you. You'll never have to take another drink as long as you live. And I really didn't know if I was there yet. But it was kind of weird. You know, when I'd sit in the bar with Melvin and go, Melvin, I'm an alcoholic. He would look at me like a dog, you know. What do you mean you're an alcoholic? He goes, if you're an alcoholic, I'm an alcoholic, and I ain't no alcoholic. Okay, that works for me. But when this guy said I had too much alcohol, it was almost like I always thought I was trying to hide my drinking. It was weird. I never liked to take a picture of myself with a beer in my hand. I don't know why that was, but like the last year, my last year of drinking, was, it wasn't horrendous, but there was a progression of loneliness. There was a progression of sadness. There was a progression of just alcoholism that slowly started sinking up on me. And I got involved in a competition in Boston. They had a competition called Boston's Funniest Bartenders. So everybody goes, Jar, you got to get in this thing. So yeah, whatever. So I went and joined this thing, right? And I get up there, and I was funny as hell, I guess, you know. But I lost to this kid I grew up with who I couldn't stand. And I still can't stand him, actually. And why was I going to tell you this story? I have no idea why I even brought it up. Boston's Funniest Bartender. So anyway, that night they actually took a picture of me, and I had a beer in my hand. And they put it in the front page of the Bartender's Gazette, whatever crap that was, you know. And everybody goes, Joe, look at you, look at you. And I was loaded. And, you know, it was almost like, if you didn't see the beer, you didn't know. I could just blend in, but I was loaded. And I looked at myself, and I was bloated and loaded and beer-holding, and I was disgusted with myself, you know. And I love drinking. Even to this day, I love drinking. I don't badmouth drink, you know, because it's fun, you know. But when it comes to the point where that's what you live for, that's what I was living for when I was like waking up. It was like Friday night was my night to stay home. I would stay home on Friday night. I lived in an Italian neighborhood. I'm not Italian. I'm Irish Catholic. And when I had hair, it was like a mop of red curly hair, just a mop, you know. And I never fit anywhere, right? I'm in an Italian neighborhood. I'm not fitting. And I'm drinking Italian wine. I don't like wine, but I drank it because that's what they sold in the neighborhood. So I would sit at home, rolling joints, listening to Willie Nelson, right? You know, I'd be sitting there listening to Willie Nelson, which there was a great album he had called The Redheaded Stranger, right? So that's me, right? So, and it was just, I would sit there and rolling joints and drinking this wine. And wine is detrimental to a lonely person, especially if you're drinking it alone. So now I'm sitting in this crazy, it was called a three-room flat or something. I forget what they called it. It was a dump. It was cheap, but it was a dump. And I'm drinking the wine, listening to Willie Nelson, Redheaded Stranger from Blue Rock, Montana. You know, and I'd be going on, and then I'd pick up the phone and I'd call my brother who's up in Santa Barbara, Jerry, the guy that calls me dude. He said, Jesus Christ, Joe. And I'm like, Jerry, my life just sucks. And then it would go down from there, right? And he would say, Joe, are you drinking wine? Yeah. So he'd say, do me a favor, put the plug in the jug and go out and drink. I know I could do that. So I would go out. And I'm a bartender in Boston, and I was a pretty well-known bartender. I could go anywhere and just walk in. It's like Norm, was it Norm? Who's Norm? I'd walk into a bar, and it was like that kind of thing. But I would always drink Beck's. I'd always drink Beck's and a shot of Absolut vodka. Love it to this day. I was actually thinking about the vodka. I shouldn't probably be alone. I wanted to be alone tonight, but I'm thinking about this Absolut vodka that I used to have in my freezer. I had it in my freezer, and I was thinking about, that's what happened on the Friday night, because Friday was my night to just have fun. And it really wasn't fun. It was desperation. It really was. You said the word desperation in such a way that I said, oh, I love that word. But I would sit at home and call Jerry, and he'd tell me to put the plug in the jug, and I'd go out and drink, and I'd roll it up, Jerry, so I could walk down. Boston's a great place to drink. It was just a great place to walk and from one bar to the next and smoke a joint and go into the place. And, hey, Joe, hey, how you doing? How you doing? I'm doing all right. And I would stand in the corner and just reduce myself to a babbling idiot. And then I would leave this joint, and I would go to another. So I never wanted anybody to see I was drunk. And I would always end up at this one place, I can't think of the name, but my friend Henry Santoro used to work at the bar. And he used to, the door would open, and I would walk in, and sometimes he would cringe. Because he could tell if I was drinking heavy that night, or if I was just drinking beer. And he told me this after I sobered. I was just, Joe, sometimes you would come in, and I would tell everybody, you're going to have to shut him off. Because it was just, I wasn't a violent guy, I was just kind of mean. I was just mean. Just mean. I was just like, you know, I didn't like people, I didn't like anybody, and if you were in my way, I just made sure that you knew that you were in my way. That's all it was. You know? I wasn't a tough guy. It was not like, if somebody ever said anything to me, I would cringe. I would piss my pants. Just go, oh, I was only kidding. But I was so afraid of what people were thinking about me. I had that liquid courage, and then it was gone. But this, the, the usually Henry's place was the last place I would go. Just before Henry's place, I would show up at Tim's Tavern. Now, this is where when I tell you I'm alone, I don't like people. I'm a loner. I hate people. So I would end up in these. Tim's Tavern was a Puerto Rican black bar in Boston. Now, this is in the era when we didn't really get along very well. So I would walk in there, and the place would be jamming, just jamming. And I would walk in, and it would go silent. I'd sit at the bar. Tim was at the bar. Tim was this big man. He'd go, "What are you having?" I'd go, "Give me a Beck's beer and an Absolute no ice." He'd give me the Beck's beer. He'd give me the Absolute with ice. I said, "No ice." He says, "I know what you said." All right. So it was fun, right? So, and it was silence. Not only silent in my head, it was silent. Nobody would talk to me or anything. I would sit there for hours drinking. And I'm a bartender. We leave sickening amounts of money to tip. So I probably had $20 worth of drink. I left $20, $40, $50 worth of tip. Next Friday night, I would get in there. And they were always watching the WWE. Not the WWF. It was the WWE then. I don't forget what. It was wrestling. So anyway, you know, so it was just really, I just didn't fit, and I was loving every moment of it. And then the next time I'd come in, now I had tipped the hell out of this guy, and now I was like a star. So I would sit down, the beer would be there, and the vodka, no ice was there, and everybody was fine. "He's cool, don't worry about me, he's cool. And I would just sit there, just for hours, just drinking all by myself, thinking about being a redheaded stranger from Blue Rock, Montana, which just, it would go on and on and on. And then I would end up at Henry's place, and he would look at me, and sometimes he'd put me in a cab. And sometimes he'd tell me to walk home. I could walk home. And I would walk home, and some nights I would just, I would end up sitting on a park bench in the city, fall asleep for hours, and then wake up going, "Phew, wow, what a great night this is." And I would go home, and I'd get into this little three-room flat, and the place was riddled with cockroaches, right? And I would walk in, and it was something, when I was really drunk, I would sneak up the stairs, because they didn't want to wake the cockroaches, right? Because I wanted to catch them in the act. This is where my mind was going. So I'd go in the house, and I'd open the door, and I'd flip on the light, and I'd see, poof, literally just like that. And I was telling people at work about this, and they go, "Joe, why don't you get some of those roach motels and get rid of those cockroaches? They're everywhere." I went, "They're my friends." And I did. I got all these roach motels, and I put them around the house one night, and I was dying to get home that night, and I come up the stairs, and I'm sneaking up the stairs, and I open the door, and I turn on the light, and there's nobody there. I was sad. It really was. I was like, "Where are they?" And now I'm on my hands and my knees looking for these little cockroaches, right? And I found the roach motels, and I don't know if you've ever, those things work, but you pick them up, and they're all inside, and they're stuck to the glue. I mean, they're in there, they're alive, and they're just going, help me, and I'm like, "Yeah, you little bastard, I got you, didn't I, you know?" And that's where I ended up. That's really where I ended up. And then this guy 12-stepped me back in 1988, and he said those words, if you ever done drinking, you have some power greater than yourself. I didn't believe it, and then on New Year's Day in 1989, what happened? I woke up, and I was alone. I had an incredible feeling of loneliness that just riddled me with fear. And I heard this guy's voice again, and I'm sitting on the edge of a bed. I didn't want to sleep in the car that night. I got a hotel room. It wasn't a hotel room, it was a flop house. And it was, I woke up and I said, "My God, I'm an alcoholic." And then I said the three words that I regretted for years. I said, "I need help." To myself, wrote it down in a little journal I was keeping at the same time. And I sat there and I went, "Is this it? Is this it? Is this all there is?" And I had no idea what to do. I was living in San Diego all alone, didn't know a soul in San Diego, didn't get this job. I didn't know what I was going to do. Somebody had stole my ice skates out of the car, and that really pissed me off, like super pissed me off. And I don't know why, the way I'm wearing a skate in San Diego, but I had brought my ice skates. And I had gone out one afternoon to find the son of a gun that stole my ice skates. I literally, this was just before the end, and I walked by this storefront that had this glass mirror kind of thing, and I looked at myself, and I was bloated and red and mean looking, just like I looked like I thought somebody that's struggling with alcoholism would look like. And I went, "Oh my God, this is pathetic. And then after I said that on New Year's Day, I actually called my brother, Jerry, dude. And I said, Jerry, I got a problem. He said, what's going on, dude? I said, I'm an alcoholic. He said, whoa, I can't help you out with that. He said, hang on a minute. And little did I know that his wife, who's his wife now, had been in an Alateen when she was a kid. And he put her on the phone. I didn't really like her. And then I didn't like her because she started kind of being stern and not really yelling, but giving me direction. You know, what are you doing? Like, leave me, you alcoholic. What are you? Get up here right away. I'm in San Diego with the Casa de Jose, which I didn't forgot to tell you had no. It had a oil leak that just guzzled out. And I got my stuff. My skates are gone. I can't find my. She says, get up here as quick as you can. Get up here as quick as you can. We're gonna help you. I'm like, oh, okay, they're gonna help me. Big deal, you know. So I get in the car and I used to have to go to Pep Boys at the time and get used oil, a case of used oil, and put it in the car. And I would put it in the top, and it would be pouring out the bottom as I'm putting them in. I'm driving down the road, and it's just this rolling black smoke coming out of the back of the car. It was like the story of my life, really. And I'm heading up to Santa Barbara. You know, it's a big old steering wheel and an AM radio, and I'm like, yeah, this is great, you know. And I finally get up there. I don't know how long it took, but she says, I made an appointment with you down at the AA Central Office. A man named Howard can talk to you. I went, oh, this is great, And I went down to the AA Central Office, and it's on 1212 State Street. You said the 12 and 12. I don't know if they do that on purpose. But I walked into this place, and it was just kind of bustling. And this guy named Howard said, hi, how you doing? I'm Howard. I says, I'm Joe. Oh, I heard about you. Sit down. Tell me what's going on. And I sat there, and I says, who are you anyway? And he told me a little bit of his story. He had 29 years of sobriety. I'm tweaking. I'm like, what? 29 years of sobriety? And then he sat in his chair and he rocked. And he said, tell me what's going on with you. And I don't know what I said. I had no idea what I said. All I wanted him to tell me was, am I an alcoholic? Can I get into Alcoholics Anonymous? That door right over there, you're welcome, you know. And he said, I said, am I an alcoholic? He said, Joe, I have no idea whether you're an alcoholic. I really don't know. You're the only one that can tell whether you're an alcoholic. I said, I'm done. I don't want to do this anymore. I just, well, what do I do? He says, well, you're going to have to go to meetings. Meetings? And he goes, it sounds to me like you're pretty afraid. You're pretty scared of the world. He says, why don't you just go to speaker meetings for a while? And I go, what's that? He goes, it's just a place where one person's going to talk. They have discussion. I mean, he went through the whole litany of what we do. He says, but the speaker meeting will probably help you come back. I don't know, whatever. And he goes, and it's at the Alano Club tonight. I hate the Alano Club. I don't like going to the Alano Club, but if you say you're going to go to the meeting, I'll go to the meeting. And he did, and I did. And I listened to some boob like myself telling his story. I have no idea what he said. But at the end of it was really weird. You know, if you're new, they pray at AA, you know, don't get freaked out by it. But, and then they hold hands. Some people like to hug, you know, and it's all crazy. I didn't know this was going to happen, right? And then they go, okay, we're going to round up and we're going to pray. And I go, Jerry goes, what's going on? I said, I have no idea. You're the one who got me here. I don't know what's going on. So we're standing there, right? And then so he reached a hand and they start saying the Lord's Prayer. Now, Jerry's a year older than me, and he's really sensitive. And he started crying. I'm embarrassed, right? He's crying. I'm standing there. I'm the one with the problem. He's crying, right? I go, what's wrong? He said, this is really cool. This is really cool. And I go, and then I go home, and I find out that my brother Brian had called Jerry when he found out that I was down at the 12th, at the central office, trying to get admitted to AA. Brian was a school teacher, a high school teacher that had taught alcohol programs, and he said, well, you know, Joe can't go anywhere without a cocktail. He's not going to go. And he said, the only way he's going to go to that meeting if you go, Jerry. Jerry goes, I'll take him. So I find out that Jerry just brought me there because he knew he would drive me there, and I would go, I ain't going in. And I went in, and he cried, and I said, well, is this it? And this is it. And then that was almost 25 years ago, and I haven't stopped coming back for that crap ever. You know, it's just like this. I think there was something happened to me when because I'm a guy that washes my arms and just get away from me. I want nothing you got. But when you take these and you put them down by your side, and then somebody grabs a hold of you, and kind of like, let's do this together. It's like when one alcoholic kind of reaches out and says, let's do this deal. Come on, let's go. Let's walk this walk. And that, you know, this wasn't going on that night. I'm going, don't touch me. Just leave me alone, you know. And Lord's Prayer, I can't do this stuff. And all of a sudden, something happened. There was a physical connection that gave me just a little spark of spirituality. I think that's all it was. I try to figure it out. And if you're trying to figure this deal out, give it up. Literally give up trying to figure out AA. Try to figure out spirituality. I'm going all over the place, but I'm going to keep going with it. And anyway, it's my sponsor, my first sponsor was Eugene. He was this 6'6" Wiccan priest. Gay, right? And I'm like, and he would drag me to the La Jolla speaker meeting on Saturday night. Come on, we're going to La Jolla speaker meeting. I'm like, wow, this is great. And we go up there every Saturday night and just listen to boobs like me just talking. It would just drive me crazy. And then this one, and then I was starting to get vocal. You know, you get a couple of weeks under your belt, a couple of days under your belt. You get a little cocky. You get a little, yeah, right, yeah, sure, yeah. You want to like sit here and go, yeah, bullshit. You know, you didn't do that. You know, it just happens in here. So he was going, you just sit here and shut up. Sit here and shut up. And then I was like, this one woman was going on and on and on and on and on. And we're in the front row, and I'm angry, just like, just pissed off, just angry at AA. Oh, not again. And it can be the longest hour of your life. You know when you're sitting there, just, and they're happy, and they're just, holy man, this happened. Shut up. You just want to stop this, you know? And then this was the embarrassing moment of my life, right? I'm in MNAA in the front row at La Jolla, and this woman said, I don't know if I've helped anybody here tonight. And I said, you didn't help me. Oh, yeah. And then she said the words, it's almost like when somebody says you got to stick around for the miracle, that. You don't know when that miracle is going to be. And for me, it happened this night. This woman said, I don't know if I've helped anybody, but let me tell you something about the God thing. There it is. There's the hook. I knew it. I knew it was coming. She said, I struggle with the concept of God all my life. And I came into AA and they wanted me to have a God in my life. And I was pissed off. And I'm like, now I'm hearing the message. And I'm looking at him and he's just that look of disgust, right? And then she said, the closest you can get to God is in the search for God. And I was like, what? The closest you can get to God is in the search for God. And I was like, that's the most profound thing I've ever heard in my life. It was almost like I wanted somebody to tell me I was an alcoholic. I can't get into AA unless you tell me I'm an alcoholic. And she said, the closest I can get to God was in the search for God. And I was like, I was freed from the bondage of Catholicism. And I don't badmouth Catholicism, can't even say it very well, but I don't badmouth it because it's the church I was brought up in, but it wasn't the language that I was willing to accept. And I get into AA and I heard a woman like this, and it was like, I have no idea who this woman was, is, if she's a circuit speaker, don't have a clue, I have nothing. And it was like, she gave me probably the best gift that I've ever had. And I was probably about 3 years sober, three angry years sober. And from that moment to this, it's been that search, you know. And it's really and it's freed me from the fear of not fitting into AA. Can you imagine not fitting in a whack job place like this? Really? I've heard, you know, some I don't really fit in AA. Really, really, why? You know, like, well, they're all sober. Yeah, whatever. You know, they're whatever. And I, because I was sitting here and I would start judging everybody. I'm sure half the room is doing it, if not three quarters tonight, just judging everybody and everything that's ever said. You know, it's just like, oh, I can do this better. I could tell a better story. I could do better. Why don't they ever have, Jesus, I can't believe that this guy's here again. Why don't, God dang it, why don't they, is there a list you can put my name on that you want me? I'm really good at this. Joe, would you like to share? No. Oh, I've got nothing to share anyway. Oh, no, I'm fine. You know? I just, bang, it was like, oh, yeah. But, and then, that and then Eugene said, Joe, there's going to come a time when people ask you to do this from the podium. I go, they ain't going to ask me. I can't. It ain't happening. And it happened. It started to happen. And it's just, there's a gift. And that's why I think I was jazzed by you guys in your group tonight. Everybody had to say something about their commitment. And everybody did it with such a passion. You know, if you're new here going, oh, God, I don't want to hear about the goddamn grapevine. This is what I don't want to listen about books. Treasurer's report? Wow! You know what I mean? I'm like, but now I don't worry about what's being said. I kind of look at how they're saying it. You know, somebody's got a commitment. They're like, got a passion. You know, you don't have to like everything in AA. Find something you like and just, you know, it's like sex, you know? It's just like, just find a position you like and do it. You know what I mean? Really, you know, don't judge them. Just like, it's like, wow. Look at this. And then you see a couple people going, you know, I really like your stuff with the literature and the way you do it. Could you show me how you do it? There's nothing to it. You know, but a guy like me is sitting there going, wow, how does she do it? Wow, how do you read the grapevine? Oh my God, that's really cool. A retro grapevine, oh my God. You know what I mean? And I'm the archivist for San Diego County. What's that mean? I have no idea, but I like people go, Joe, you're the historian. I ain't nothing. I just, you know, I collect crap and I reorganize it and I make it look good so you guys can go, wow, that looks really good. And I go, yeah, I know, it's a lot of work. I'm going to give you a pat in the back, but it's just a passion that I have. It's just something. So if you find some sort of passion in here, and the passion, if it's judging, make it good. You know, really, don't come into AA and go, you know, I don't fit. You know, you're going to fit. You're going to find a group of people. Did you hear the whack job last Friday night? Yeah, weren't you stupid? Yeah. But all of a sudden, you start having a communication. One alcoholic starts talking to another alcoholic, doesn't matter how you're talking, but then something happens. You start talking about the seemingly hopeless state of mind and body, which is your mind and your body, and you're talking with another alcoholic, and then you guys have a connection, and all of a sudden you go, hey, you want to go hear somebody else? Hey, you want to go here? Hey, I heard this is a great group. Hey, this is pretty cool. And you get in the car and you start doing stupid stuff, and all of a sudden you're not thinking about drinking, you're thinking about just like taking a journey somewhere. And that really is, I think that's what Bill Wilson talks about, being rocketed into a fourth dimension of existence. I thought it was at the top of the hill in La Jolla. And my sponsor says, Joe, I hate to disappoint you, but it's right here and right now. I go, what? That's it. That's the best you can get in AA is now. And if you can do that and take that word and turn it around, spell it backwards, it says you've won. I go, what? I says, yeah, it's pretty cool. Now give this crap away to somebody else. Oh, you don't mean, yeah, I do. Help somebody. When your seemingly hopeless state of mind and body is taking you to a place when you're seemingly hopeless, turn to somebody else who has no hope and go, listen, this is what I did. This is what happened when I did it, and this is what's going on with me right now. And if you do those things, they go, you're kidding. And how do you get there? Let's do it together. And then it's usually go, we're going to go to Denny's. Oh, shit. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, you want to go to Denny's with us tonight? What are you, nuts? You know? I'm going to get a nice moon over my hammy sandwich or something like that. You know? And we'll have a milkshake and stay up till 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning just like the old days. Oh, no way. And then you do those things and you start having a conversation. The next thing you know, you got a little fellowship that's going pretty cool. And all of a sudden you go home and you go, wow, I actually had pretty fun last night, you know. I had a good time. And then you go to conventions if you want. If you don't worry about it. Go to meetings and judge them. That's fine. You know, it worked for me. And then all of a sudden I go, I stopped all the negativity and I find the positive in AA. That's all I've done. And it's just an attitude shift. It's what you were talking about, that sixth and seventh step. I think the longer you're sober, if you're not getting into those sixth and seventh steps. My sponsor, Eugene, this was pretty cool. He said, Joe, I want to talk about the sixth and seventh step. He says, you're on the crucifix 99% of the day. He says, get up on the crucifix. So he literally made me stand here like this, right? He says, now I want you to number the steps on your arm. I went, okay. So I go, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Right? And he goes, what's right between 6 and 7? So I'm just like this. He goes, that's the problem right there, right between 6 and 7. So they're not the problem. Your old ideas are keeping you in bondage of self. The fear of everybody and everything and all your ideas of what you think life should be like keeping you in this bondage of self. You got to change those things. How do I do that? Well, let's do another inventory. And we did another inventory so I could discover what my defects are. Not your defect. I would always look at your defect. They did, she did, he did, they did. They're gonna, they will, they have. He says, forget about all that stuff. He said, what was your reaction to all that stuff? Oh. And then I found out those things. And he made me get a dictionary and a thesaurus and look these words up and just change my thinking into a new way and a new action. And I believe that's what really happened to me. I got rocketed into a fourth dimension that is, Bill Wilson calls indescribably wonderful. I have a guy who I sponsored that's got just a little less time than me, and he was a grand poobah in AA. He was like a delegate down in San Diego for years, and now he's taking acting classes, right? And he's becoming a pretty good actor. Shakespearean crap and all that sort of stuff. But it's like, I don't understand it. I have no idea what you guys are saying. And he said, listen to the music of acting until you can understand the words. The same stuff we do in here. He called me up the other night. He had a dilemma. And he goes, Joe, I've got a chance for an audition on a great play or whatever, and I don't know whether to take it because I have a commitment in AA. Now, this might be a little contrary to what a lot of people in AA think. I said, you got to go on the audition. Go on the audition. Bill Wilson calls being sober indescribably wonderful. He does not ever say, don't do what you want to do. He says, find a life that is indescribably wonderful. And Joel was like, well, what happens if I get it? I said, you don't know anything yet. Take the audition and see what happens from there. And if you get that, then you come back to us and say, listen, I've got an opportunity to improve a passion in my life that I have to grow for. And he goes, well, I didn't think you were going to say that. I said, why wouldn't I say that? My own experience is that I always thought the grass would be greener on the other side of the street, but I would never cross the street to get to the other side to see if it was greener. I would always think that things were better over there. I would always think that maybe there's another Friday night speaker going on that's probably a lot better than the one you're hearing tonight. I would always do those things, so I would live in this fear of a perception of reality that wasn't truth. And he was like, oh, my God. And I said, and if you get it, then you take the next step. If you don't get it, then you take the next step. But if you don't follow your bliss, follow your passion, follow that thing that you think you want to do, that's what God's telling you to do. Your head is saying, oh my God, I tell you to commit me, and what do they think of me now if I do this? And I go, that hasn't happened yet. And you've got a whole world manufactured. Dr. Paul said, the magic magnifying mind. We create problems that just aren't there. That's what we do all the time when we're sober. It's like, oh my God, Jesus Christ, what if I did this? Oh, I can't. Oh, I'm not there. Oh my God, I can't do this stuff. I just can't do it. I just can't do it. It's like, you know, it's like the guy that has an accident in the car and they go, I'm an alcoholic, call AA. And he calls your sponsor, you go, don't call AA, call AAA. What are you calling me for? You know what I mean? AAA will help you with the car. AA ain't going to help you with the car. Now get that straight and then get back on path here. So that's what I've done in AA. That's, you know, if you're struggling with Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't know why I'm so giddy tonight. If you're struggling with Alcoholics Anonymous, don't leave AA without telling somebody you're struggling with AA. I see so many people leave AA, go out to a bar and start drinking at AA. Drinking at AA. Alcoholics Anonymous. Poof. Rather than say, you know what, I just don't know what's wrong. I don't fit. I don't know what's wrong. Because when you say that, you're saying to somebody, I need help. You don't know you're saying those things. But if you're in AA with your arms crossed with the best, don't ever come at me again. I don't want nothing to do with AA. I don't want nothing to do with Happy, Joyous, and Free people. Turn to somebody and go, how you doing? And they're going to go, you look like shit, kid. You know? And I go, I know. How'd you know that? Well, and then all of a sudden you start a conversation, and then sometimes it might take hours to get to that point where you can say, I don't like what I'm doing. And somebody might say, let's do something different. You mean it's something different? I don't know. But what you're doing ain't working. Let me help you get to some place where it's going to work for you. There's so many, what Zinni used to say, there's a wrench for every nut that walks into AA. You know, we don't all get here the same way. We don't all have to stay here the same way. We can actually find the language. Another guy used to say, my God is, how did he say it? He said, my God listens to this. No, how did he say it? Oh, shit, I can't remember. My God listens to the same kind of music I do. He said that at a PB meeting. I kind of went, my God listens to the same kind of music I do. That just floored me. stupid little crap like this kind of made me come back going, that was profound. Did you hear that? Well, he says that all the time. I said, I never heard it. It's new to me. But it really worked for me. You know, it was like I had an old idea, and then all of a sudden I changed the channel, and I got a new idea. So all I did was change the channel. You know, FM, AM, it doesn't make any difference. Now CD, Cirrus, we got all this stuff. We got MP3s playing, and people are all different. They're walking around, they're listening to different music, whatever it is, but they're getting some sort of joy out of it. The first line in the 12th step, in the 12 and 12, says, joy of living is our code. But there's a little caveat after that. It says, but action is the key word. I was an inactive person in Alcoholics Anonymous. I came into AA judging you guys, thinking I could do it better, wishing you would do it better, hoping that AA would get better. And none of that worked until I just stopped judging and started being exactly what I am in here. Just an alcoholic of the hopeless variety. And I try to turn to somebody that I think has a little bit of hopelessness in their life and go, listen, this is what I did. You want to try it? You don't have to if you don't want to. But they go, but you don't, well, maybe if I don't understand, maybe I can find somebody that helps you understand. When I turn that person towards somebody else that they have an identification with, and I watch those two people walk around AA together, my job is done. My job is done trying to direct somebody toward a power that's greater than themselves. That's what my sponsor's done to me. That's what I try to do to somebody else. This isn't magic. Magic is something I could teach you. I could teach you, and I could teach you, and I could show you the trick, and you could show everybody else. AA is mysterious. It's all it is. It's a mystery. Sometimes we don't know how things work. You know, we read how it works, but sometimes AA works in a mystery. And in that mystery, I think that's the spirituality. That's the ritual of the spiritual. It's just something we do over and over and over again. And all of a sudden, wow, did you hear that? The closest I can get to God is in the search for God. And all along, I realized that I was in the search for God. I didn't know what the solution was. I was so afraid to ask the questions. All of a sudden, somebody gave me an answer to a question I was afraid to ask. And I found something that I think is indescribably wonderful. All that little stuff has happened to me everywhere in AA. Everywhere I go. Everywhere I go. It's just, I'm going to shut up here now because I'm just, one of my favorite pamphlets, if you knew, is A Member's Eye View of Alcoholics Anonymous. There's about three or four. There's one up here. If you've never got it, if you can't, the big book is too big for most people. Most people don't even read anymore. You know, they don't even read. What are you, nuts? Can I get it online? Jesus, can you text it to me? Christ, I'm not going to read it. That thing's huge. I can't read that. And these are great little pamphlets. But this was written by a guy named Alan McGinnis who's passed away up in L.A. And it's just a story of him telling what AA is like to the professional community, and it's just let me read one thing because this is kind of cool. I just love it. There's so many little nuggets in here. But this is and usually when I want to find it, I can't find. Oh, I'm personally convinced that the basic search of every human being from the cradle to the grave is to find at least one other human before he can stand completely naked, stripped of all pretense or defense, and trust that person not to hurt him, because that other person has stripped himself naked too. This lifelong search can begin to end with the first AA encounter. That's identification. That's all it is. It's just like one alcoholic. Because our story, our secrets, whatever they are, they're the things that we don't want to give up. Those are the things that we don't. If I'm going to tell you the thing is whatever they are, the thing that's kept me in bondage of self, how do I trust that you're not going to tell everybody else? You don't know. You don't know. And I think that's where that relationship with a sponsor and a sponsee just becomes a huge benefit in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because when I tell you my secret and I walk away free and I realize that that person will never divulge that secret to anybody, it's no longer a secret in my head. It's a secret in his head. But it's now become a burdenless person. That's all I've become. And if you're not there yet, give yourself some time. Give yourself some hope. Give yourself some reason to turn to somebody and go, I need help with this. I don't know how to do this. I can't get to where you're at. How do I do that? And I say, sorry. I thought that if I just told you to go read this, this, and this, and this, and this, you're going to do that. Then I realize you're not going to really do that. Let me read it together with you. Let me do this stuff together with you. Let's walk hand in hand. One more story and I'll shut up. My Guy K that I've been sponsoring for years went out years ago. He just got 10 years. He went out and he OD'd on heroin and he was blue-coated out, dead. And they revived him, thank God. Anyway, so, But he called me up, and we went to a meeting the next day, and he was just sweating like I am right now. Just like, oh, this is, oh my God, I gave up on the sobriety. And I'm sitting there, he goes, what are we going to do, Joe? What are we going to do? We're in a meeting. I go, I don't know what we're going to do. So I'm sitting there, and I go, God, I need help. I don't know what to do. And then I got an idea. And I started smiling. He says, what's going on? I said, I'll tell you later. I got an idea what we're going to do. And he says, what are we going to do? I says, you're going to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. He says, what? And I go, you want to know something? I have never been given that direction. Nor have I ever given that direction. Therefore, I've never done that. Therefore, I can't tell you to do something that I've never done. So we are going to do 90 meetings in 90 days. And we did that. And I've never given that direction again. Ever. So if you're given that direction and you ain't done it, or you're not willing to do it, don't do it. Trust me. If you don't think this deal works, try it. Just try it. And if you don't think God will help you, all you got to do is ask. Peace.